Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about caches. And last time we left off, we had gotten to our associative cache. And we talked about some extra things we needed to care about besides just this read path, where we take in an address, look at the appropriate set of the cache, get out some tags, compare them, and if one of them is a match, we give the appropriate part of the data to the processor, and if it's not, we tell the processor it's not a hit, and we go to memory. We also talked about how we do writes, and we had our two different choices. So one was we had to choose whether or not we were going to write through or write back. In write through, we don't keep track of anything, we just always send things to memory. But in write back, we had this extra dirty bit that we added in order to know, did this value change and has it not been written to memory yet? So when we eventually remove the value from our cache, because our replacement policy says, oh, this is the oldest value here, for example, we know to write it to memory. And we had another decision about whether or not we allocate on write, about whether or not, if it's not already in the cache and we get a write, do we care? We have to update it if we do have it in the cache, but if we don't, we have a choice. And real caches make both possible choices, either fetching the block from memory and updating it in the cache, or fetching nothing from memory and just sending the write to memory without doing anything. So one thing we didn't mention is, you know, why something like write through or, you know, write no allocate would be reasonably efficient. Why would we not be concerned that all this time we're spending talking to memory is going to make things really slow? And an important feature that we have in real caches is that there's a write buffer. So when the CPU writes something, the cache doesn't immediately send it to memory and wait for that to finish. It has a little buffer, a little mini cache of things that have been logically written but haven't made it to memory yet. And this allows the cache to respond quickly to a write, even if it's a write-through cache and it needs to talk to memory. And this is a ubiquitous feature in modern caches. You don't have to have one of these, but it makes things a lot faster if you don't have to wait for every write to complete. And this also makes that write-back policy a lot less bad. If we didn't have a write buffer when we did a write back, that would mean that a read would have to wait for a memory write to complete, and that would be pretty slow. So instead, we can use this write buffer, and we only wait if we are out of space in our write buffer, if we have too many writes happening overall, rather than waiting for how long a particular write takes. So now that we know about the basic operation of cache, I'd like to move on to talking about what this means for program performance. But before I move on, are there questions, comments about how caches work mechanically? Yes?
So is the write buffer essentially like a register?
Yeah, you can think of it as that. There's usually more entries than one. But yes, essentially like a little register. The idea is that we don't have to, you know, we have a place to put the value, so we don't have to keep it in the cache until we're done writing it. Other questions? Okay, so let's consider a simple example for a program which cares about the cache, which is going to be to compute the sum of a matrix and probably return 8, which I omitted from this code. So here we just iterate through all entries in a two-dimensional array and add them all up. And this array is not going to fit in registers, so we're going to access the cache. And if it didn't start in the cache, we're definitely going to have some cache misses. And how many cache misses we're going to have is going to depend not just on what we have to add up, but the order we access it in. So here, we've chosen a particular access pattern, a particular order to process this data. So we're going to read entry 00, then 01, 02, and so on. And eventually, we're going to go to the next row of the matrix and read 1, 0, and so on. So if we want to know how this is going to look for the cache, what are some things we need to know about, besides that this is the order we're accessing things in? Yes?
The block size?
So we need to know the block size, yes. So we need to know the block size because that's going to say, when we access this 00, what are we actually going to read in? Anything else that would be helpful to know? So let's start by considering how this is laid out in memory, which I guess people assume just knew, but that's also important to know. So our typical layout, if we're having, say, 4 bytes per row, since ints are 4 bytes, is that we'd have 4 bytes for 00, followed immediately in memory by 4 bytes for 01, 4 bytes for 02, because this is how C lays out a two-dimensional array. It's not the only way we could store this data, but that's how C lays out a two-dimensional array. And if our cache block is, say, 8 bytes, a cache block is going to contain a continuous piece of memory. So if we have an 8-byte cache block, and let's say 00 starts at the beginning of a cache block, just because the lower bits of the address happen to be that way, then 00 and 01 will be in the same cache block. And we access 00 in the first iteration of the loop, 01 in the second iteration, which means that if we have to fetch this cache block in the first iteration of the loop, on the second iteration, we'll have a cache hit. And so this is where our caches give us a win for spatial locality. So temporal locality we got just because we had something in the cache and it was there again because we put it in the cache the first time. The wins for spatial locality are going to primarily come from having block cache blocks which hold more than one value we care about. So here, we did a miss to get the first entry of the array, and we cared about the second one. And happily, it happened to be in the same block because the cache is designed by having a block size larger than 4 bytes to give us an advantage for having good spatial locality. So is there a problem with just making the block size larger to, be better at giving spatial locality? So if I think programs have good spatial locality, should I just make the block size as big as I can? Yes? So if you say if you make it too large, we'll just get a bunch of misses. So what's the cause of those misses?
Because you're going to have to keep iterating through the spaces in the block, right?
The spaces?
Yeah. So that's a miss. And then the next one is in the same block.
Yeah.
But it's a hit.
Yeah.
Right. So like if you have a bunch of spaces in the block, like you might have a bunch of misses until you get a hit, right? So it might just take a while.
So if we have a larger block size, we're gonna have instead of an 8-byte block, we might have, say, 1,000-byte block. So this whole thing is one block.
But we don't iterate through it.
Yeah, we don't iterate through it, right.
We know where in the block to go based on the block offset from the address.
Yeah, so if you remember here, this is how we got the right part of the block. So we're going to have a mux here. So for a larger block size, this mux, you know, if we have 1,000 bytes in our block, we'll just have 1,000 inputs. So we won't iterate through it, and with this, with here, so if we had a larger block, for what this is doing, we'd have just more hits. Because we'd have that first miss, and everything else would be a hit. And we're not iterating through the block to find something. You are right to be concerned that we still have to find the right part of the block. We have that mux there. And one thing you might be concerned by is what's going to happen when we make this mux bigger. And one thing that's going to be true is that this is probably going to be slower. Because if it's bigger, just because it's more wiring complexity. So that's one disadvantage to having more blocks. Now, your idea that we might have more misses if we have a larger block size is correct, but just for a different reason. So can someone think of why we would have more misses if we made our block size very large without making the cache any bigger? So if we have a very large block, that means we can store less blocks in our cache if we have the same size. So if we have a very large block, let's say it doesn't happen to line up correctly here. So let's say the end of a huge block is right here, just because our array doesn't happen to be on a multiple of 4 address. That would mean that when we loaded this, we would load a block which ends here and goes all the way, way, way up. And we might not have very many blocks in our cache if we have large blocks. Very many sets, rather. If we have very few number sets. And that means we're more likely to have an issue where something later on in the array, which was in cache, now conflicts with that block. Or something later on we're accessing elsewhere in the program. So the compromise is that larger blocks mean you have fewer blocks you can store in total, because you're using a larger portion of the cache every time you get something from memory. And therefore, you're replacing a larger portion of the cache. So this means that if you have very large blocks, your cache is less good at exploiting temporal locality. So in those cases where a program has better temporal locality and OK spatial locality, that large block size might not be a net win, because you'll be better at exploiting the spatial locality the program has, but you might be worse at exploiting the temporal locality, because you'll evict things in order to bring in a larger block. You'll have to use that space, you know, for something else, rather than something that the program might have accessed again. So, but generally, it will be true that, you know, for most programs, as long as we don't have ridiculous block sizes, usually it's better to have a larger block size. With the caveat that our limitation is usually going to be that mux we have in our cache. If we make that mux very large, our cache will be slow, and that will defeat the point of going to cache instead of memory. There's other parts of the cache which will be slow if we have a larger block size. Can someone think of some of those? What other things does the cache need to do which are going to be badly affected by its block size?
Replacements.
So when the cache needs to bring in a new block, if we have a larger block size, that means on every miss, we're going to spend more time bringing in something from memory or writing something out to memory, just because we have a larger thing to write or in a larger thing to read. And that's another big cost of a larger block size. And usually the combination of the cost of selecting the byte and doing the replacements and are going to limit the actual block size you see in processors. Not the issue that when you have really large block sizes, you're not so good at exploiting temporal locality. And this is why we see pretty modest block sizes like 64 bytes, even though many of the programs we really care about, you know, might access larger chunks of data than that. So let's go back to our matrix sum program. And I've made a simple change here. So previously, this loop was I and this loop was j. I've just swapped them. So now instead of accessing 0, 0, 01, we're accessing 0, 0, 1, 0, 2, 0, and eventually we're accessing 0, 1 again. So is this change going to change the performance of this program? Is anything going to change about how this program performs? Let's try to go through possible ways that could happen. So first of all, is the number of instructions in this program different than it was before, since I swapped the I and the J loops? Who thinks the number of instructions is different? Thinks it's the same. So everyone thinks, yeah, we didn't change any of the number of instructions. So that means that if this is more or less efficient, it has to be because some instruction, like a load or a branch, took longer. So could loads in this program take longer than the other program? Anyone think yes? Yes, they can? Okay. Anyone have an explanation for why?
If it's putting stuff in the cache memory and accessing the next thing, it's like located further down, so it's going to keep like replacing things.
Okay, so you're worried that this has worse spatial locality. We saw that our array is right out, so 0, 0 and 1, 0 are pretty far apart. And our intuition about what caches help with is locality. And this program clearly has worse locality in that sense. So you're right. So there's a reason to believe, based on that it might have worse performance. And you're particularly worried that we might be replacing things we're accessing later. So any other thoughts on differences in performance with this program? So let me show you a case where we could have the most worst performance by changing the order of the loops. So I've written out our same array. I've just written out what iteration we access each element in. So we access 0, 0, 1, 0, and 2, 0, which is not shown, 3, 0, and then 0, 1, and the fourth iteration number 4, and so on. And we have, our cache blocks. Or that should be four iterations. So this is, so we have our cache blocks. And here, and this, this is what we're going to load. We're going to load this in iteration 0. And we need this to still be in the cache in order for that to be a hit, like it was before. So we're going to run into trouble if somehow this isn't missed next time. And the worst possible thing which could happen is if accessing this got rid of the thing we wanted an iteration for. That would be the worst possible thing. That if every time we access something, we replace what we just got. And it turns out that we could imagine a cache where this happens. So there's multiple ways of doing this. So one is, if a cache has one block, that's definitely going to happen. But there's another way we could have this problem where we access something for 00, bring in this first cache block here, and then it gets replaced immediately when we access 10. How could that happen? So how does the cache know what to replace when we access something? Yes.
Doesn't it looks for like the memory spot that was like used the last, like it was used the most longest ago.
So it does, but it only does that within a set. So you're right, so that's our normal policy, but it does that only for the blocks in this set. So here, if we say have something which is index 0, then yeah, we're going to say, let's replace the oldest thing in this set here, of these two blocks. But we're not going to consider these two spaces. So from that, can you construct a scenario where it? No, okay, but don't want to put you on the spot. But you're right. So we're thinking out. Yeah. So normally, if we have a choice, we're not going to replace the thing we just got. So the situation where we're going to be in trouble is if we don't have a choice. And there was one type of cache we talked about last time where we don't have a choice. Yes, which is exactly a direct map, which just means we have only one thing in each row, only one block in each set. So if we have a direct map cache, we might say, oh, it's in this set, and we don't have any choice. We have to replace it. And that could happen. If, say, you know, this is set 0, this is set 1, set 2, set 3, set 4, and then maybe when we get down to, say, 20, it's set 0 again. If we have a direct map cache, this direct map cache may store 8 sets of 8 bytes each, which is a lot of space for this array, for this matrix, which is not that big. But we're going to run into trouble. We're going to not get our hit here because we're going to access something else that needs to go to set 0. And this problem is particularly bad because it happens that our matrix rows have 8 elements. What's wrong with 8? Yes?
It's a power of 2, so you might get thrashing.
Yeah, so it's a power of 2. So we get what the textbook calls thrashing, which is that when we look at a power of 2 and add that to an address, we don't change some of the bits in the address typically, right? Because it's all zeros in binary at the bottom. And some of the bits we're not changing could be the index bits, the bits that we're going to use to determine this 0, 1, 2, 3. And if we're not changing those, that means as we iterate through our matrix in column order here, the sets aren't changing very much. So we're accessing set 0, set 4, set 0, set 4, and so on. So we're not using a large part of the cache here in our first few iterations of the loop. So this is, you know, a form of bad spatial locality because we're skipping around, but it's actually worse because we happen to choose to skip by a power of 2. If we skip by, say, 6, we'd use all the cache blocks before we started over. But we just happen to choose a power of 2, and the cache happens to use powers of 2 itself, and these coincide. And we ran into a problem. So what are some strategies we could use to avoid these sorts of conflicts? Either as a hardware designer or as a programmer. So any thoughts about what we've learned about one thing caches do to avoid these conflicts as a hardware designer, people who make caches do to make this problem less bad? Yes?
Is it as a software designer you can use prime numbers as the size of your array?
So as a software designer, we can do things like, yes, we could not have our arrays be powers of two. More simply, we can do the difference I started with, which is that we want to access in this order, I then j, rather than the other order. Right? As a programmer, that's a choice you can actually make. And that's a choice you can more often make than not using prime numbers or something like that for your array indices. So what was, yeah?
Is it like when we talked about last class, we make the cache, like the E-way set associative?
Yeah, so the other thing, the technique we had was associativity, was making the cache wider, having not just one place to put things, but two places. So if you have two places, we could still run into the same sort of problem, but it's going to be harder. We're going to have more extra chances. We can at least store two things if we happen to have the set number be the same. And possibly more if we choose to use a wider associativity. And so that's our hardware solution, is adding associativity. And this is a reason why many, many caches you see have associativity, because it's pretty easy to run into this case, especially when you're doing things with arrays and matrices and things like that, where you use a power of two somewhere, or something happens to be close to a power of two. And if you didn't have, more than one place to put that value, you'd run into conflicts with values used close in time, just because something you were iterating, skipping ahead 128 entries or something like that. So this is why we pay the cost of associativity, of having extra complexity in our cache. We need to implement a replacement policy. We need to have multiple tag comparisons and choose a value to get out, which turns out to actually be a surprisingly big problem for cache performance. But it's worth doing because these conflicts are so common in real programs. And note that they don't have to be. Like, as a programmer, if you're really careful, you could write code which has no conflictnesses, which has none of these cases where you replace something you just accessed because you happen to choose a wrong interval. But real programs can't always do this and don't always do this. And a question you might have, generally, is we have all these choices, like how much associativity to use, what size of a cache to use, how big blocks to make. How do you determine what you actually do as a hardware designer? And the way hardware designers generally figure this out is they run simulations. Is that they write something which acts like a cache does. So they do exactly what we've done in our examples, where we split things up into set and index and tag bits, and we figure out what goes in each cache entry. They just write a program to do that, and they run it reading what some real benchmarks do. So for example, here are some results from a 2000 benchmark set with a 64-byte block size and LRU replacement for what happens when you change cache sizes and associativities. And these were obtained, some people at Wisconsin did this work, and basically the way they did it is they wrote that simulator for a cache and something to read a program and figure out and simulate it like your processor simulator to figure out what all the memory accesses were. And after something like 100 days of CPU time, really, that's how long this takes, they got these numbers. And you know, if you're a hardware designer, you're going to do something like this to decide, is it worth adding a more sensitivity to my cache? You're also going to consider how much slower does that make it. But this is how you make those sorts of decisions. And one thing worth noting, that's a general thing that's true about programs people have looked at in practice, is that almost all the time, you get most of the benefit from a sensitivity when you have a little bit of it. So here, you know, once we get a two-way associative cache, going up all the way up to 8 helps us some, but it's not huge. And going all the way up to fully associative helps us a little bit more, but it's not huge. And this is typically what we see. And this is why it's not worth trying to have a cache where we have a huge number of places to put things. Just because empirically, when we look at real programs, it doesn't help performance that much. And it's a whole lot of extra complexity for a, you know, getting rid of 0.1% of your miss rate. So another thing you can see from this is that there's a working set size. There's some size after which we basically, you know, we've basically gotten everything we can out of the cache. So for these benchmarks, it seems like, you know, most of their benefit comes once you have around 128 kilobytes. They're pretty small. And that's, you can think of as the amount of data the program needs to run quickly. You know, it's not more than that. That's probably what the innards of the program are working with as far as how much data. And this varies between programs. We can easily write a program which has a very high miss rate for 128 kilobyte cache. How would you do that? How would you give me a program where all the miss rates here were like, miss rates here were like 90%? This is an easy program to write, it turns out. Or 100%. How would you write a program where instead of having, you know, 0.27% of cache accesses missing, you know, I have 100%, yes?
Could you just make a program that looks up everything on the computer, like, for no reason?
Yeah, so just access every single memory location once and repeat after starting with the first one you accessed. There's absolutely no way the cache is going to keep that thing you accessed.
With a big stretch.
We're not talking about prefetching yet. So for the caches we know about, it's sufficient just to access everything and then access everything again, because we have the maximum possible interval between accesses. We have the worst possible temporal locality. And if you want to be even worse for that, you would make sure you access a cache block and then you access a different cache block that you interleave that way. So you have the worst possible spatial locality. So you can construct programs which make caches look arbitrarily bad. And this is an important thing to remember when you're thinking about whether caches help. You can always make a cache look bad. You can make a cache worthless by making sure you just, you know, look at what's in it and choose something to access that's not in it. So with that in mind, that you can always make caches look bad, let's talk about whether LRU is always better. So LRU is the replacement policy everyone wants to use. And it works because it exploits temporal locality. Right? So if our programs have temporal locality, LRU is good. What's going to happen if our programs don't have temporal locality? Can we make LRU look worse than, say, random? Or a direct map cache? So if you're an evil benchmarker and you want to prove to someone that they're wasting their time with LRU, how do you construct that benchmark to show them that their cache is horrible and my direct map cache is better? Do you think this is possible? Who thinks you can do this? Okay. Who thinks probably not? Okay, so any thoughts on why besides things I'm implying? Share? Or what sort of procedure you, how you think about, go about doing this, what you want to look at? Okay, so it is possible, and the way I go about doing this is I keep track of what's in the cache. And if I want to make a cache look bad, I just need to access something it doesn't have. So here's an example of an access pattern, which makes a two-entry direct map cache look worse than a fully associative LRU cache. And it's just because I was particularly mean about how I what I chose to access. I got the cache into a state. So here, I said, oh, the direct map cache has zero. And the zero here, and the fully associative one doesn't. And I decided, okay, that means I'll access zero. Right? This is something an evil program could do. So what's the reason we don't have to worry about this for real caches? We don't have to worry about this sort of problem. So what is reading zero here good locality compared to reading something in the fully associative cache? So if you look, the last time you read zero was two accesses ago, and the last time you read three was one, and one was two. All right. So we have worse temporal locality for this access than the other two choices that would have been a hit in the fully associative cache. So the reason that this access pattern is worse for makes our LRU cache look bad, why it's not always better, is because I don't have temporal locality here. And I've deliberately chosen something with bad temporal locality. So one lesson you can get from this is that if you want to make a cache look bad, you just keep track of what it's doing and say, and just accessing something that it just, you know, got rid of. Yeah?
So the reason why this wouldn't be a problem for normal caches is because most programs do naturally have temporal locality.
Yeah, so most programs are going to have better temporal locality than not. Here, I'm deliberately choosing the worst temporal locality every time there's a disagreement between the direct mapped and fully associative cache. I'm accessing zero when one or three would be better temporal locality. I'm accessing three when zero or two would be better temporal locality. I'm deliberately making the choice that we've learned is not typical of programs. But it's important to know that caches just don't always do better because when they have these fancier features like LRU or more associativity. It's because they're taking advantage of how programs work. So the basic technique, if you ever want to make a cache look bad, is you fill the cache, and then you just access the thing that you just replaced. And that's guaranteed all misses. And it's also pretty almost always true that if you choose a cache which is very slightly larger, this will be a perfectly fine access pattern for it. or if you choose a cache with a very slightly different organization, different associativity, that usually it won't happen to replace the exact same things. So you can always make a cache look bad, but the question we actually want to answer is, how does a cache look with typical programs? And that means that we have locality, both spatial and temporal, and that we have some occasional conflicts in the low order bits, so a little bit of associativity is going to be helpful. And these are not things that you could know by just looking at what the instruction set is. These are things you have to know what typical programs look like. And the people who designed caches discovered this by actually measuring lots of programs. So keeping in mind this idea that typical programs have a locality, we have a whole bunch of ways that we can change how fast our cache is if we're a hardware designer. And they have different effects on different parts of the performance. And we have to consider all of them if we're a hardware designer. So for example, if we wanted the caches to have a really great miss rate, to never have misses, we just choose huge, huge caches. But real systems don't choose the largest possible cache you could possibly have, because that has some disadvantages. And a way you can think about these trade-offs is that there's three big quantities we care about when we're talking about cache performance. So one is miss rate. That's how often, when a typical program accesses the cache, is it going to be a hit or not? And this is a property that depends on our assumptions about locality for a typical program. Another property is hit time. How long does it take to read a value from the cache in the case it's a hit? And making the cache more complex generally will increase the hit time, because it means that we have a larger mux, which takes longer for a signal to go through. So we'll have a slower cache. And that might be worth it if we have a higher hit rate, if we have less misses. Another issue is the miss penalty, how long it takes in the case where we need to get something from memory. And we've talked about sort of three big optimizations about choosing our three parameters: our associativity, our block size, and our cache size. And these all have, if you increase the cache size or associativity, those both generally improve your hit rate. But the reason that we don't just choose the largest possible cache size and the largest possible associativity is that they generally hurt your hit time. So all your memory accesses will be slower if you try to increase your associativity really high. So they don't increase it that much, but they want to increase it enough that the miss rate goes down. Also, when you increase associativity, you have a higher penalty for misses. You have a longer time to do a replacement. So why is that? What about associativity makes it take longer on a miss, not just a hit? Yes?
Longer with associativity because you have to calculate what you're going to replace anytime there's a miss?
Yes, exactly. So we have to figure out which of several blocks to replace on a miss, and that can take a bit longer. You also have to update related information. So there's a little extra time for a larger, higher associativity. And we also have to have the logic to bring the value to the correct block. So for the block size, I've written down that it depends, because at extremely large block sizes, you get into this problem where you're worse for temporal locality. So this doesn't happen for any block sizes real processors use, but they're avoiding the case where it's bad. Because increasing the block size makes your hit time worse, because you have to get a larger thing through that mux where we select, for based on the offset bits, what part of the block to return to the processor. And it also increases the miss penalty because we have to bring in more stuff from memory, or write more stuff out to memory on a replacement. So we also mentioned different write policies. And these write policies generally improve the hit rate. Having a write allocate cache generally improves the hit rate because it's kind of common for programs to write something and then read something else from the same block. And having write back improves the hit rate because usually if a program writes something, we're just going to read it again. We don't need to go to memory. But these can make that's where we dash. But these make the miss penalty worse. We have more work to do on a miss. LRU replacement also generally increases, improves the miss rate, but makes the miss penalty worse because we have a more complicated decision to make than something like FIFO. Or random. Another thing that we didn't talk about much is secondary caches. So I mentioned that my laptop last time had an L1, an L2, and an L3 cache. So it has multiple layers of cache. And the reason you add a secondary cache is that you can make your first level cache look a lot better by effectively making misses faster. So our L2 cache handles misses from the L1. And by having an L2 cache, that miss penalty is way down. So it looks like our L1 cache is just a whole lot faster. And similarly, having the L3 makes the L2 look faster. So this is the reason you see a hierarchy of caches. So you can get the hit time of the fastest cache, but have a lower miss penalty, because you can use a more complicated cache for this. The second level cache, that second level cache can have a very low miss rate and can spend more time, and you can still decrease the miss penalty. But having all these levels of cache means that designing cache hierarchies is very complicated, because not only do we need to do the simulations we needed to do to get this table, but we need to do the version of it where we say, here's the sizes of the L1, and here's the sizes of the L2, and here's the sizes of the L3, and here are all the possible associativities, and run out all those numbers to figure out what set cache we want. So that's the enormous space that processor designers have to play with. But they're all going for basically the same idea, that they're going to compute these numbers based on the programs they have, which is going to give them their miss rates. And then they're going to look at their hardware design and say, how long will it take on a hit? How long will it take on a miss? So questions about these performance changes? Okay.
Why is LRU replacement for hit time a question mark?
It might be slower. You might have to do more work on a hit to keep track of what was least recently used. I think the answer is usually that it doesn't matter, because you can do that work while you're getting the data, but I'm not sure. And it presumably varies.
I mean, if it's big enough, that would take more time than the hit.
Yeah.
So it depends on the size of your associativity.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about how we can actually take advantage of caches as programmers. And let's look at a simple example. So I'm going to square a matrix here. So this is A times A in matrix math is B. And I can implement this with a triply nested loop where I just do this multiplication and add it to the appropriate part of B. So I have a loop where I happen to access different elements of A in order for this thing. I access A with a large interval between elements for the second term. And I access B elements, all the same ones, for the inner loop.
Have you seen the flat array for 2D array before
We should mention that, yes. So in order to represent a variable size array, and also to make it clearer what things are next to each other in memory, I'm using a one-dimensional array to represent an n by n matrix. So I times n plus j means I'm accessing, means I'm skipping by n I times and adding j, and that's to get ij. This is rather than using a real two-dimensional array, because in real code, I want to vary n. And varying n with a C two-dimensional array is not something you can do. So that's what I'm going to be using for today, is that sort of notation. Just because if you actually write code that does this in C, that's what you're typically going to use, just because you need variable size arrays. So another option for writing the same thing is that I could, instead of doing this k loop in the middle of the loop, it's very most often, I could do it on the outside. And this is exactly the same calculation. It just happens to do it in a different order. And we saw with the matrix sum that one of these might be faster than the other. So which one do people, think about it for a minute. Which one do you think is likely to be faster because of the cache? And yeah, just share your answer with your neighbor, and I'll get back to you in a minute.
Better temporal locality for the Z thing, because your that only depends on I and J when you change those leads.
Okay. So who thinks the first version is better? Who thinks? Okay. One person, two people, three. Okay. Four or five. Who thinks the second version is better? Okay. Any advocates for the first version being better? Want to share your reasoning? Okay.
You're talking about you want to have the outside one be the row and the inside one is the column. So you want I, which is representing like accessing the row, to be the outside one?
Outside one. Okay, because we want J on the inside, is your thoughts.
Or J and K on the
inside. J and K on the inside. So you think this IJK order is better. Okay? Because we have this spatial locality here. Okay? Advocates for the alternate order? Yes?
I feel like because K is the number of, N is the number of summations you're doing, but K is the element that's, the variable that's controlling that.
Yeah.
Like, I just feel like you would want to bound I and J by that, because you're multiplying them by K. So you would only want to go K times, and, I feel like K should be the one that's, controlling me.
So K is limited by N, so the limits are the same. So the thought that we had there of let's look for locality is, I think, the way you should probably should try going about this. And so one thought is that, hey, if we have k on the inside, don't we have better locality here? And since, isn't that better? Now, it turns out, if you look at, and here, we have bad locality in k, from k. So that's a reason you might think that this is a lot slower. On the other hand, this has good locality in B. And this has not as good locality in B. This has good temporal locality in B, and not as good spatial locality. This has good temporal, this has, good spatial locality and pretty bad temporal locality in B. But if you look carefully, this has very good temporal locality in this A axis. And pretty good spatial locality in this A axis. And that's not obvious. You have to go very systematically through that to figure it out. I wouldn't expect people to have figured that out. But it turns out that if you actually run these programs, you get this sort of performance where n is on the bottom. So that's the size of the matrices. So they're n by n. So they have the same number of instructions get run. Those lines exactly overlap. And here's how many cycles they take. So the Kij order is about twice as fast. And another way we'll often view this sort of performance is cycles per an instruction. Because that tells us a lot about how long memory is taking, because memory is the usual reason our instructions will take a lot of cycles. And we can see that we have this sort of difference. And we also have these interesting spikes, which I assure you are not a measurement error. So as I said, the way you'd figure this out without just running it, though running it is the best way to figure it out, mostly, is that in the Kij order, we have two things with spatial locality and something with temporal locality. In the other order, we have one thing with spatial locality and one thing with temporal locality. And that's where the win came from. It's a bit surprising, it's as big as it is, perhaps. And that's sort of that's what the big gain was. That's why we have this huge gap in performance. So questions about this? Yes?
Can you go back to the slide you were just at?
This one? Or?
No, the one that said like Bij. Yeah.
Yeah.
So why does Bij have temporal locality?
It has spatial locality here.
In the second one?
In the second one, because in the inner loop, we're accessing, in the ijk order, we're accessing different k's in the same I and j over and over again. So we're accessing the same bij. Okay. So another way we can look at this is we could look at how often do we have cache misses. And it turns out you can measure that with the appropriate tools. So here's the rates of cache misses for the two first programs. And if you thought that there was some measurement error before from all those little spikes, you might sure think I don't know how to measure cache misses. But I'm also pretty confident that there's not a measurement error here. So let's look at what's going on with this data. And I'm only going to look at the data for the K as the inner loop, the bad loop order, to keep things less cluttered. And I'm going to zoom in on the first part of the graph. So the first thing to note is we have this region where we have almost no cache misses. And that's where the matrix in its entirety, all of A and B, fit in the L1 cache. So in that case, the cache is perfect. The problems come when they don't all fit, and we run out of space. So then, you know, we have a typical rate, and we have these outliers here, which are real measurements. I took 10 measurements and took the median. And this is consistent between runs. So I'm very confident they're real measurements. So why the heck at this value here, which is, by the way, 92, why at 92 is performance worse? Or if you want an easier case, this is 2 to the 7, 128. Why at 128 is performance worse? Yes? Yeah, because we have the, we access things which map to the same set because we're incrementing by roughly a power of 2 for 2 to the 7, exactly a power of 2. And it happens that we don't change the index bits of the address very much. So we're not using all of the cache. We're only using a couple sets in one of our loops. Just because n is a power of 2, so adding n to the address tends to get to the same set or one of a small number of sets and then back to the same set again. So we have misses from conflicts. We can't actually put all the values in that column of the matrix or the row of the matrix in the same part of the cache. In all of the cache. We can only use a little bit of the cache. So that explains 2 to the 7. And for 92, it turns out that 92 times 11 is almost 2 to the 10. And that's why this happens. And 114, which is here, times 9 is almost 2 to the 10. So in particular, that might be 90, I forget whether it's 93 or 92, but we have times 11, we get 63.9 cache blocks apart. And there's 64 sets in the cache. So almost always, they end up mapping to the same set. As long as it's not the first thing in the block, those two adding, going 11 columns over gives us the same set. And so this is the reason we get our performance anomalies. So they're real. And they're an issue that you might eventually want to deal with when you have to write code like this. But they're not measurement errors. But our biggest win, you know, overall, was just having the right loop order. So another thing we can look at besides L1 cache misses is we can also look at other levels of the cache. Because those also are places where we want to have good performance. And it turns out that the wrong loop order is worse in all the levels of the cache, because it has worse locality overall. So for example, we have more L2 misses. Note that the scale here is like 4 or 5. Whereas with L1 misses, it was like 10 or 20 or 30 per 1,000 instructions. But the L2 cache, remember, is like twice as slow, or four times as slow. So these misses matter more. And note that we have an even more pronounced version of that pattern where we have conflict misses being a problem. So we know that we can change loop orders, and let's try to think about this idea about how we get good performance in our cache, how we access things in the right order more systematically. So let's look at our loop order. And our general goal is going to be to get the most out of each cache miss. That's what your goal as a programmer should be, to get good efficiency from your cache. Because cache misses are a cost you're going to have to pay at least once, because you need to get the value from memory. And you want to do the most work every time you have a cache miss. And one way of thinking about it is, let's say n is really big. how much work are we getting from this loop here out of a cache miss? So when we, if n is really big, then we access Bij. And by the time we get to the next iteration of the k loop, it's not in the cache anymore. Because n is so big that we can't we're going to access enough other stuff before we access it again. We don't have enough locality. So we're going to get one computation done with Bij, and that's it. If we think about Aik here, then we're going to access it n times for the first time we access it. Because every iteration of this inner loop, we access it again. So it's going to be in the cache. Yeah. We're going to get it in the cache once, and we're going to get to do n computations with it. For akj here, we access it once, you know, once in each iteration of the I loop. But if n is big, we're accessing a lot of things, a lot of akj elements, before we access the same one again. And if n is big, there's going to be a lot of iterations of this j loop. And it's not going to be in the cache the next time we access it, because that's n accesses later. So when n is large, we're doing a lot of work for every element of Aik, and not so much work for Bij and Akj. So we have really good efficiency in one thing, and pretty horrible efficiency in the other. And one way of thinking about this is that our cache is being used for one thing when n is really big, and is effectively useless for everything else. And we'd really like the cache to actually be useful for more than one thing. And another way of reasoning about this, which I find generally helpful, is that you can pretend that you're loading things in the cache when you enter a loop. So you actually don't load things explicitly into the cache, but all you're doing is changing where you're counting something as loading. Because when you access it the first time, that's going to put it in the cache. So you can say that when we start this loop, it's as if we're loading Aik. So we load Aik once, and then in each of these loops, we load Bij and Akj. And you can use this to count just how many times do we load things from memory. And your goal as a programmer is to try to get this number lower without changing what computation you do. To get the ratio between the amount of actual work you do and the number of loads to be as low as possible. And you can, one thing you can do is you can reason about different loop orders and what that means. But we're going to have a sort of more general approach for dealing with problems like this and making them work in the cache. So I'd like to start by, you know, showing this approach with a little trick. So I've just rewritten the program we already had in a slightly different way. Instead of having a loop over k, I have a loop over some double k, which I then use to do a loop over 2k elements. So I've just written the loop over k as two loops. Seems like a waste of time. It's going to make the program take more instructions. But this is going to give us some flexibility. So is everyone convinced that this is the same program, assuming n is even? Hopefully. So what I'm going to do now is the same thing we started out by doing, which is changing the order in which we do loops. So I'm going to move the k loop, the one which only goes over two things, from out here to inside here. So why would I want to do this? It seems like it's just, you know, moving things around. It turns out if we expand that loop, that we have better locality. So I now have temporal locality in B that I didn't have before. Or I have temporal locality in B that I didn't have before with the Kij order. Because I'm using it twice instead of just once. So I'm getting more work done for that one miss of B I'm going to have to do at the beginning of this section of code. I have better spatial locality in the AI Ks, because I'm accessing two consecutive Ks right next to each other rather than the inner loop just being in jet. And I didn't lose most of the advantages I had from the original loop order because I still have good temporal locality in AKJ. I'm still accessing it over and over again with not many operations in between. I don't have N things done before I access AKJ the next time. I'm only doing like two. So this transformation is going to help our performance even more, in addition to the improvement we had from changing the loop order. So in particular, let's look at the miss rate again. So here's miss rate for the unblocked version. And here's what happens if we just do blocks of two Ks at a time in the innermost loop. So we got basically twice as much work done. Sorry, we got half as many misses to do the same amount of work. And that's just by doing this transformation where we incremented one of our elements to do a block of two Ks instead of just one K at a time. So we're still getting most of the advantages of the best loop order, but we're doing more work in each of the innermost iterations. So instead of just keeping effectively one thing in the cache, we're actually using the cache for this BIJ and this AIK, which we weren't really before. And you might say, if we did that for K, why can't we do it for some of the other loops? And we can. So we can do the same transformation for I, for example. And we'll get still better locality. I've written these out differently because writing out the C code does not fit comfortably in the slide. But in this case, we still have more reuse of things we didn't have before. We have more reuse of the AKJs. Than we had before. So we're just doing still more work for every time we load something. So we're ending up with a case where when we're loading a block of A and you're processing a block of a 2x2 block of AIK and using this to process a little bit of B and J, and we're getting still that N calculations per an element of AIK we load, but we're doing two for each thing we load from the other things that we need in our loose loop. So we're getting a lot more efficiency. So why did we choose two? There's no reason to just do two. We could do more. So we could, instead of doing two, we can do big K and big I elements. We can do a larger amount of things. And we should get the same advantages. We should have cases where we're reusing things besides AIK in the innermost loop. That we actually get extra use in here because we access BIJ big K times. We access AKJ big I times. So we're getting a lot of calculations done for each thing we load, whereas before we were only getting a handful. So as long as we can safely make these K, I, and J big enough and not run out of space in our cache, we should get better performance. So our constraint here is that we're going to load, we're going to have these blocks loaded in the cache, and they need to actually fit. But as long as they fit, we should actually have better performance, just because we've added more locality here. So, questions, comments? So next time, Luther will finish explaining cache blocking, and I'll go on to other performance optimizations, many of which don't involve caches.